All right, well, let's get started. Got a small group today, so you know, let's try to make it as interactive as possible. Feel free to interrupt me or with questions or whatever. Kind of keep it informal. But tonight we're going to talk about mindfulness of the body. Here's a quote from the Buddha. If the body is not mastered by meditation, then the mind cannot be mastered. If the body is mastered, then the mind is mastered. He went on to say, there's one thing, monks, that cultivated and regularly practiced leads to a deep sense of urgency, to the supreme peace, to realizing deliverance, to wisdom, and the fruition of holiness. It's mindfulness of the body. So the Buddha really considered mindfulness of the body very important to his teachings and very important to, you know, gaining insight and awakening. And so this basically comes from some teachings called the Satipatthana Sutta. This is a teaching that the Buddha gave on mindfulness and meditation. It's probably his most in-depth teaching on meditation. There's like hundreds and hundreds of pages of teachings of the Buddha, but there's surprisingly little actually on meditation. There's the Satipatthana, and then there's Anapanasati, which is mindfulness of breathing. And those are the main teachings about meditation. The rest of them are kind of about the overall path and the Dharma and the teachings and things like that. And the teachings don't go into a great deal of detail. I mean, they're pretty terse. And so, you know, they kind of have to be unpacked. It, you know, helps to have, you know, the teachers over the years, teachers have expanded on them. There's been commentaries, things like that. That's exactly what the Buddha meant on some of this. But so this is what we're going to be talking about tonight. This information on mindfulness of the body comes out of the Satipatthana Sutta. And the very first part of this is mindfulness of breathing. Of the Satipatthana is mindfulness of breathing, which, you know, actually is mindfulness of the body. It's just a subset of the body, the sensations that are related to breathing. And so we've all been practicing this to one extent or another. Most of us have when we do the breath meditation. But what tonight we're going to talk about, you know, some other ways to use the body in terms of meditation and contemplation. You know, one thing we saw in the guided meditation was a scan, was to go through the body kind of piece by piece, and see what kind of sensations that we found there. And the other one is a couple weeks ago I talked about walking meditation, and that's another way to be mindful of the body. We're more mindful of the sensations of walking, sensations at the feet, as opposed to just the breath. So another practice we're going to talk about, the first practice we're going to talk about, it's called meditating in the four postures. And this is what the Buddha had to say about that. A monk has full awareness while coming and going, while reaching out his hands or drawing them back, while putting on his robes or carrying his bowl, while eating, drinking, chewing, tasting, even while defecating and urinating. He has full awareness while walking, so that's one of the postures, standing, another one, sitting, and while lying or falling asleep and waking up, while talking and while remaining silent. You know, I've heard of some teachers that actually, like, especially on long retreats, they actually have their students know whether they fell asleep on an in-breath or an out-breath. And whether the first breath when they woke up was, you know, whether they noticed the in-breath first or the out-breath. So that takes quite a bit of awareness to be that aware of what's going on. But, you know, as you practice more, as you get in, especially in a retreat setting, the mind gets sharper and you start noticing more and more. You build up that continuity of mindfulness and you start noticing more and more. So here's a quote from a book by James Joyce. It's a character, and he said about this character, he said, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. And if you think about that, I think a lot of us do that. We kind of get caught up in our thoughts, we kind of get caught up in our head, and we tend to not have a whole lot of body awareness. Especially if we're doing something intellectual, you know, working on the computer, sometimes in conversation we get lost, we don't have much awareness of our body. And, you know, we start building up a lot of tension because we're not aware of that. You know, it's really easy to tense up while we're doing something. And then that could have health consequences. You know, our modern life has become so mental. You know, so many jobs are office type jobs, and then we come home, we surf the internet, you know, we watch television. So we tend to be in our head a lot and not so much into our body. So that's what we're really trying to do with these practices, is really get more back and get into our body. So how do we practice the four postures? Well, basically the first thing is when you're sitting, you're aware that you're sitting. When you're standing, you're aware that you're standing. You know, when you're walking, you're aware that you're walking. And same thing with lying down. So that's one part of it. But then also it's more than just being aware that you're in that posture. It's actually what sort of sensations do you feel? You know, if you're walking along, you know, you may feel the sensations of your feet. As you walk along, you may feel other body sensations. You know, if you're outside, you might feel a breeze on your body. So what we're trying to do with this is we're trying to keep as much awareness as we can in our body while we're going through our routine activities. You know, even if we're having a conversation or something like listening to someone, we actually can listen more effectively if we keep a little bit of awareness in the body and then also keep the rest of our awareness on the person that we're talking to. Because a lot of us tend to, you know, we're listening, but we're thinking about what we might say next. You know, our brain tends to jump ahead. And so what we want to do is that body awareness, it also keeps us, you know, if emotions start to arise, if it's an emotionally charged conversation, staying in our body gives us an anchor there. We start to notice if there's some kind of emotion coming up, you know, maybe it's anger, or maybe it's restlessness, that sort of thing. So staying in our body can really help us also stay in touch with our emotions as well. So we can also notice the transitions between these postures, you know. As we can feel, what does it feel like to go from sitting to standing, or from standing to walking? And so it really serves as a nice anchor to help us stay mindful, you know, throughout the rest of our day. It's just that body awareness. And I've heard numerous teachers recommend, you know, if you don't cultivate anything else, it's this body awareness. Keep some awareness in your body. That's one of the quickest ways to gain insight and become more awake. You know, we can also, as we're practicing the postures, it also kind of reveals quite a bit about our mental state as well. Say we're walking along, you know, and we realize we're rushing. You know, maybe we're going to a meeting, we're kind of leaning into it. We're thinking about what we're going to do or say in the meeting, and we're not really in the present moment. So as we have that anchor in our body, we can also see what's going on in our mind. So it really helps because, you know, thoughts, if we're just in our thoughts, they tend to go from one thought to another. They can tend to jump around. But just having that anchor, you know, we do that with the breath and meditation. The breath is our anchor. And we can see, if we have an anchor, we can see if our attention's moving somewhere else. So that can be very, very beneficial. So questions on that so far?
Have you been able to know if you fell asleep on an in-breath or
not? I have not. I've tried it.
Really challenging.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I've been able to keep quite a bit of awareness as I've fallen asleep, but not to that level, because the thing is, you're getting sleepy at the same time, right?
Right. I'm going to try to do that tonight.
Yeah, it's definitely worth trying to see. And I've gotten better about it. You know, I can stay with the breath until I go to sleep, but I got a little too fuzzy to really tell what I was doing at that point. But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, the more you practice, the sharper your mind gets. And you know, one thing the Buddha taught with this mindfulness of the four postures, we can actually gain insight into the three characteristics just by doing this practice. The Buddha said, when this fathom-long body and mind, within this fathom-long body and mind is found all of the teachings. So it very much is an embodied practice. It's not necessarily like we have to do all this intellectual pondering and things like that. It's very much an embodied practice. Just being in our body, seeing what our mind is doing, is really, we can find all the teachings within that very framework. And so the first, there's three characteristics that the Buddha talked about that you start to have insight into. You start learning about, that can actually start transforming your life as you experience these insights. You know, the first one is impermanence. The second one is dukkha. It's often translated as suffering, but I think that's not the best translation because people say, well, I'm not really suffering, so I don't have dukkha in my life. But a better translation is like the dissatisfactoriness of life. You know, we all have dissatisfaction in our life. Maybe we have, you know, impatience, minor annoyances, but it can run the whole gamut to true suffering, true physical and mental suffering. So that's the second characteristic. And then the third one is selflessness. the nature of ourself, how we, our mind built, takes these sensations in and builds up a concept of a self around that. And we've been doing it since we were little kids, so it's a very natural habit. So those are the three characteristics. And in practicing, doing this practicing, being in our body, noticing our postures, can help us to have insight into these different characteristics. For example, with impermanence, you know, one thing is that you might start noticing is that you're constantly shifting your posture. You know, even as we're sitting here, you know, we're shifting positions. There's a great deal of impermanence just in our postures, you know, throughout the day. Maybe at one time we're sitting in the same posture, but we feel different sensations. You know, maybe you feel something in your knee, or maybe you feel something in your back. Maybe you feel your bottom on the cushion. So our the sensations are constantly changing. We're just kind of in this flux of sensation. And you know, you can even notice that. Sit for 5 minutes and just notice how many times you change posture or want to change posture. So that can be a very eye-opening to see just how impermanent really our posture is and sensations are. How they come and go. Sometimes when we get a pain, we think it's going to last forever, but if we really examine it, we realize that it fluctuates just like anything else. You know, luckily we're not in pain for most of us for days, or constant pain for days or hours or months even. So let's try a little exercise. Close your eyes, hold your arm out, and just move your arm back and forth any way you want, and just be aware of any sensations that you feel associated with this. You know, are these sensations constant or are they changing? I mean, do we feel one big sensation that's the arm, or is the arm made up of a lot of smaller sensations? You know, are the sensations pleasant or unpleasant? Or neutral? Is it one big block of sensations that make up your arm, or does it feel like there's space there between the sensations? You know, as you start to hold your arm up longer, are there some unpleasant sensations associated with doing that? Okay, now you can lower it. So what did that feel like? What did you experience?
It feels less fluid when I concentrate on it than if I'm not. I just do this. But when I thought about it like that, it felt like a bunch of little independent movements or joints and things.
Okay, so you were feeling the sensations associated with the movement?
Yeah, a bunch of different things. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because we tend to, I think we tend to kind of solidify things.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting exercise.
It also feels kind of creaky. It makes me feel a little bit old, like it popped.
Yeah, that happens too.
I broke this arm in a bike accident a couple years ago, and I had hardware put in it. So when I did this, it would actually pop as it like went over the hardware. And now I just got it taken out. So it's interesting, because I definitely feel the absence of that. Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yes, it's not something that we do that often, so it's kind of a different way of experiencing the world. Because our mind likes to think in concepts. We can think very quickly in big concepts. And we do that. We think of an arm, but you know what really is an arm? You know, is it this one constant thing, or is it this flux of sensations? Okay. Well, one way we can examine dukkha is to we start to examine why we're changing postures. So if we're doing that exercise where you're going to sit still for a minute and see how many times you change posture, notice why. Why you're doing it? What's the motivation behind it? And typically, it's to relieve some kind of discomfort. We have some sort of discomfort, and we're trying to get rid of it. And that's what the Buddha the Buddha called that aversion. You know, we try to get away from things that are unpleasant. We try to move towards things that are pleasant. And so, or maybe we have the hope that if we do move to different posture, then things will be more pleasant. And you'll see that comes up quite often in meditation. You know, when you, after you've been sitting for a while, you know, you have some sensations that, you know, that you're, that are unpleasant, and you think, well, if I just move my knee a little bit, I feel better. You know, I'd have more pleasant sensations. So, I had a realization of this on a retreat. I'd been sitting on the retreat for several days, and the line was starting to get sharper, and so I was sitting there, and I realized that I had this thought that, oh, I want this meditation to end. You know, when's the bell gonna ring? And I realized that what had triggered that was just a really kind of minor, a very minor unpleasant sensation. You know, I don't remember if it was my knee or my back or something like that. But looking back on it, because I caught it right away, you know, why I wanted to move. And it was just a very minor little sensation, you know. But yet my mind took that and built it into a concept and said, yeah, I want to move. I'm ready for this bell to ring. And I was just amazed at the fact that it did that. It wasn't like I was in excruciating pain or anything. It was just one little unpleasant sensation, and boom, the mind wanted to do something else. And so to me, that was very eye-opening when I saw that. You know, and the mind also tends to project into the future, you know. Maybe you have a sensation that, oh, it's not too bad, but then your mind starts thinking, well, I can't tolerate this. 15 minutes from now, this pain's really going to be bad, you know. I know I've had that sensation as well. I can't possibly make it till the end of the set or till the bell at this rate. But then the impermanence thing kicks in. As you start to examine it, you realize that, well, sometimes it goes away, or maybe you have other sensations that draw your attention and things like that. And so you start to notice that it's not as permanent as we thought it was. And it doesn't necessarily progress linearly. I mean, sometimes the pain does get worse and worse as the longer you sit. But often it doesn't. And that's an interesting examination in your meditation too. When you have a painful sensation, you know, turn, and especially if it keeps bringing your attention to it, you know, just turn your attention to it and examine it. And, you know, try to zoom out a little bit so you can kind of feel the boundaries of that sensation. Notice, is it changing? Is it fluctuating? You know, is it, you know, is there one part that's stronger than another? You know, and that can be a very interesting examination to work with pain that way. Because what I've found is that pain is not as solid as we tend to think it is when we examine it closely like that. Often I thought of pain as always, it's just this kind of constant throbbing or stabbing or whatever. But then I realized, no, it really isn't. You know, there's periods it might go away for 4 or 5 seconds. Then it comes back for 4 or 5 or 6 or whatever. Then it goes away for 1 second. Then it comes back. And, you know, it gets stronger and it gets weaker. So that's a very interesting examination, too, to do. And how our mind takes those sensations and creates that mental resistance. That's where the dukkha really comes from. We're always going to have negative sensations in our life. But what we're trying to work on and what's possible is to eliminate that mental reaction to it. You know, the Buddha called that the second arrow, because we resist it. And the more we resist pain, the worse it gets. And a teacher named Shinzen Young, who actually helped found this center, he coined the phrase that suffering equals pain times resistance. So if we have a lot of pain and very little resistance, then we don't have much suffering. We can have a little bit of pain and a lot of resistance, and we have a lot of suffering. And that's something interesting to investigate in your life, you know. Does our mind's reaction, you know, two people might experience the same sensation, but one person has a lot more resistance and they actually have a lot more suffering to the same situation. So, you know, maybe we get up to go eat. You know, what's driving that? What is it that make, and that's a good examination, what makes us get up and go to eat? Well, there's some kind of sensation in our body that tells us that we're hungry. And, you know, sometimes they're fairly weak, sometimes they're stronger. If it's been a long time since you've eaten, then they tend to get stronger, and the urgency to go eat gets a little bit stronger. So those are also interesting to investigate, you know, that. I've also found that hunger is much, if you're mindful with the hunger sensations, that it's much easier to deal with. Then if you're not really very mindful, then that hunger can be, oh, I've got to eat, you know, it becomes really very urgent. But if you can step back and just observe those sensations as sensations, then it's very tolerable. You can go a lot longer without eating, especially if, you know, if you can't go eat or whatever. You know, the monks in monasteries often just eat one meal a day. They have one, usually it's breakfast. They have a large breakfast, and then they don't eat again till the next morning. Usually in the afternoon they have some kind of drink, coffee or something like that, but they only have one solid meal a day. But they learn, and that's one reason they do it, is that they can learn to work with those sensations, learn to work with desire. And like, I heard this story where a teacher had asked a monk, how many times did you chew that first bite of food to see how good his mindfulness was? You know, because he's really hungry at that point. You know, he hadn't eaten in 24 hours and he's really ready to eat. Was he still mindful, or was he just kind of shoveling the food in? You know, so was he mindful enough to know how many times he chewed the food? Which I thought was interesting. Questions on impermanence or dukkha or thoughts?
I experience it with restlessness, like when I'm meditating. So I'm trying to be aware of that. Like I want to move just to move. Like it's just like I want to just stretch my arm or, you know. So I'm trying to work with that before I let myself do it. Like, why do I know I just want to do this just to, because I'm resistant to just sitting, you know, because I struggle with that, just restlessness.
I see.
So, but I'm trying to be aware of that, to not just give in and just get up and stretch, or
that's
to just observe that, like, okay, I want to stretch my arm right now, I don't need to stretch my arm right now, so where is this coming from? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So. Have you ever noticed that when that, so you're like, oh, I don't really need to move my arm right now, and then you'll be fine, and a couple months you're like, I really don't need to move that arm, and then the third or fourth time I'll just do this.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell was that? Like, it wasn't even a thought, it just happened.
Right.
Yeah,
that intention was coming from some part of your mind that you weren't necessarily aware of.
And sometimes I'll catch it, and sometimes it'll just happen. It'll be very surprising, right?
But. That's interesting. Well, they've done some studies, some brain studies, where like the intention to move often comes before we're actually consciously aware that we're going to move. So when they do those studies, they can see where the intention comes from, and it's really before we're even aware of it. So there's some part of our mind, there's different parts of our mind that have different jobs and functions, and things happen subconsciously without necessarily us consciously intending for it to happen. You know, have you ever done something like you knock something off a shelf and then you catch it before you even realize it, you knocked it over? Mm-hmm. There's some part of your mind that was quick enough to actually do that.
And but as you practice meditation more, people get better at not doing these movements, right? So how does that work if the intention to move comes before you're aware of it, how do people get better at not being restless?
Well, basically you set an intention not to be restless, and that kind of and the more you have that intention, it's an unconscious process as well, but it can override that other intention. So one intention can override another intention. And sometimes there are, you know, as you start practicing, energy starts flowing in your body, and you actually do get spontaneous movements that, you know, sometimes people rock or different things like that, or, you know, it can cause like a jerk. And I have that happen sometimes, and I've been working with that, having the intention not to move. And it actually tends to stop it. Sometimes it breaks through, but just having that intention, it's not like I have to sit there and constantly tell it not to move, but I just say, okay, I'm not going to move. And then it starts kind of manifesting. Instead of a movement, it's kind of an energy flow throughout the body.
Well, I have that in the last couple of months, rocking during meditation. And I just observe it. Like, I'm not trying to do it. I can stop it. But I wondered, I was going to ask about that eventually. Like, I'm sure I'm not the only, you know, other people that have experienced that. Is it just, should I not let myself do that, or...
Well, there's different ways of working with it, and I think different teachers have different opinions. Because, you know, as our mind starts to get settled, then we do start to get these energy movements that can cause movements. And you know, you can just leave it in the background if it's not very distracting. You can just let those movements be in the background, and just work with it that way. Or you know, just observe. You know, just have some awareness that's happening. But it can also be an interesting thing to have that intention not to move. and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one, to see if it does stop, and then two, does that energy do something different? You know, do you get a different type of energy movement?
Well, I noticed first it was rocking forward, and now it's rocking side to side. Like, first it was like a month of rocking forward, now it's been a couple months of side to side. Like, I'm just curious what will happen next, because I'm not doing it deliberately at all.
Right.
But I noticed it just takes no effort to stop it.
You've had the intention to stop it.
Yeah, I can stop it, but it just will come at some point during the meditation, sometimes immediately, sometimes tonight it was like halfway through because I wasn't very settled for a long time. But I just think it's interesting, so I've just been letting it go, but I wasn't sure, should I not do it or, you know, let it do that? Or
well, one thing I've heard, though, if it ever gets to be like a kind of like a crutch for your meditation, if you're using that rhythmic rocking mm-hmm. to kind of space out or something like that, mm-hmm. then that's the time you might want to actually try to stop it.
Okay.
But I would say, you know, as long as you're still keeping that peripheral awareness mm-hmm. and you just have that awareness of that going on.
Yeah.
And it's not too distracting. Sometimes I get really, really violent movements.
Okay.
And then that really kind of breaks my concentration when I do that.
Right.
So that's why I've been working with those to actually have the intention to stop them.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's like it's funny because you get deeper into meditation and then you get these get these violent movements and then it kind of brings you out. So, but it's also interesting to note if you have, if you are pulled towards those movements, if you like them and want them to continue, or if you have aversion to them, mm-hmm. something like that, is to notice your mind's reaction to the movements one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Because some things like the rocking can actually be kind of pleasant and soothing as well. So it's interesting to notice that as well. Okay, well, let's talk about the selflessness aspect that we can gain some insight into that through this practice. You know, as we start to examine these sensations, we kind of start to see the impersonal nature of what's arising. We just see that, you know, these different sensations are just coming, and we start to have as we get more continuity of our mindfulness, we start to see that there's these sensations, and then there's the knowing of the sensations. And this process just kind of keeps going on, and you might start to see how we build a self around sensations. You know, instead of saying hunger is arising, we say I'm hungry. Or instead of saying anger is arising, or sensations of anger, you know, you might feel it in your heart or your stomach or your face. Instead of doing that, we say, I'm angry. We automatically tend to take these sensations and we build them into a self. And that's how the mind builds this concept of self. Because we basically have sensations from the physical world, and we also have our thoughts. And, you know, if we examine them at the lower level, then like when you're moving the arm, they're just sensations. But then the mind tends to like to latch onto that, and it tends to build a self around that. But as we start to practice this more and more, develop more continuity, we realize that there's really no one behind this process. These are just these processes that are happening due to causes and conditions that come in our life. And sometimes we get the feeling that, you know, like if we're doing walking meditation, that we're being walked. We're not consciously walking, that we're being walked, that the walking is happening. Or you might have felt this in a breath meditation, that suddenly it's not me that's breathing anymore. Breath is just happening, or I'm being breathed. Some people get that feeling, that some force outside of what we call ourself is doing the breathing. And, you know, obviously there is subconscious processes in our body that are controlling the breathing, but I think ourself likes to think that we're in control of a lot of things that we aren't necessarily in control of. Or if the self tries to take control of it, it kind of messes it up. I don't know if you've ever tried to control your breath, but sometimes you can actually mess it up and start hyperventilating and stuff like that. So the self is, you know, it's got some things that it's good at, but a lot of those things, those autonomous processes, it's not very good at. You know, I've noticed that with things like, you know, sports or playing a musical instrument. The more my self gets involved and tries to take control, the more it messes things up. So that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. Another thing we start to see is kind of this interaction between mind and matter. So we have these sensations, and those sensations often, you know, color our mind. If we have painful sensations, you know, our mind has aversion to that and wants to get rid of them. Or if we have pleasant sensations, then our mind wants more of that. How do we get more of these pleasant sensations? So there's this interactive effect between our mind and matter, and then and also the state of our mind can condition the way we perceive matter as well. You know, if we're frustrated and tired and upset, then we may take what would normally would be a sensation that wouldn't bother us too much, and we make it into a much bigger deal than it would be otherwise. So those two things are the mind and what we experience in the world are constantly working together. They're constantly influencing each other. Or maybe you hear something, maybe you hear a sound in your environment, and instantly in your mind you pops up an image of what you think that is. You know, if it's a bird, you might see an image of the bird, or if it's a car, you might see an image of the car as well. So there's that constant interaction. We start to see that relationship as we delve more deeply into this. So, you know, as we develop more and more continuity of these postures, when we start to develop more awareness into impermanence. So instead of just kind of noticing impermanence every now and then, we start to notice it more frequently. So the more continuous we can keep our mindfulness, then the more often we notice it. And the more we notice something like that, the more it conditions our mind, the more insights that we get out of it. You know, we often have insights that are very fleeting, and they don't really change us much or influence us much. But, you know, the more often that we perceive some of these insights, then the greater effect they're going to have on us, the less suffering we're going to have, that sort of thing. And it kind of helps free us from identifying the body as a permanent self. You know, we think, oh, this is me, this body's me. But if you really think about it, you know, is this the same body you had when you were 12? You know, there's lots of changes. Every cell, I think somebody said like every 7 years, all of our cells change in our body, something like that. And so you know, we tend to think of ourselves as something semi-permanent, but then there's things like looking in the mirror, we realize that we are changing constantly. And so this is what the Buddha told his son, who was named Rahula. You should see all phenomena with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This is not I. This is not myself. And you know, that's what we tend to do. My hunger, I'm hungry. But what the Buddha said was, we need to see it, we just need to see it as phenomena without necessarily identifying with it. And that comes with practice. You can't just suddenly stop doing that. But the more you see this impermanence, the more you see the dukkha, the more you see that through the sense of self, then the more able you're willing to do that. And that leads to freedom, the more freedom you have. This is a quote from Joseph Goldstein. He's a senior meditation teacher here in the United States. He says this about mindfulness of postures. One of the most effective ways of bringing the insights of retreat practice into your daily life is through mindfulness of postures. So if you can keep some mindfulness of your body while you're changing postures, and he says you can gain a lot of the same insights that you would on a retreat. So that's something to keep in mind. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It's just develop as much continuity as you can of the mindfulness. So any questions about that practice or the results or anything?
How do we get better at being aware of having these insights? You said like we have them once in a while, but they don't cause a permanent change. They're too infrequent. But what practice do I do to make it more frequent?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, if you have a regular meditation practice, you're developing those skills of mind. You're developing some ability to keep your attention where you would like it to stay. Then you're also developing that peripheral awareness that we've talked about. So, and those two skills, Chula Dasa defines mindfulness as the optimal interaction between attention and awareness. So we can focus our attention on something fairly closely, but we still have some awareness about what's going on. So if you develop those skills during meditation, then you're more able to take those into your daily life. So then in your daily life, you have that intention to just keep some attention on your body as you're going through your daily activities. You know, as you get up and down, you're doing things like doing the dishes, you know, you pick up the phone. What's the receiver feel like in your hand? You know, what does it feel like against your ear? So you're just noticing body sensations as you go through your regular day. And slowly, you know, as you build those skills, then you're able to do that more continuously. And so maybe at first in the morning you go, you have really great intentions. You know, I'm going to be mindful today. Well, maybe you're mindful through breakfast and maybe brushing your teeth, and that's about it. And then it goes away. But you know, with practice, you still have that. And then maybe you're mindful a little bit more the next day. Maybe a couple other things during the day you tend to be mindful. And Joseph Goldstein also said that mindfulness is easy. It's remembering to be mindful. That's the hard part. Another practice that has helped me is when you do sit down to meditate, reflect on the mindfulness between this meditation and your last meditation. So how many moments of mindfulness did you, at a high level, how mindful were you between that? And without judgment, you know, don't beat yourself up if you weren't that mindful, but just that reflection every day tends to make you a little bit more mindful that day before your next meditation, because you know you're going to check in and see if you're mindful. So as you develop this mindfulness, you start to see more and more how things work at the lower level. Outside of the concepts, we see you're kind of drilling down a little bit to the lower level and seeing more how things work. And then as you do that, then you start to have more insight. The more continuity of mindfulness you have, then the more frequent insights you're going to have. And so that's kind of how that process all builds. Chula Dasa talks about, you know, meditating in the morning and then not being mindful at all throughout the rest of the day. It's like filling up a tub and then immediately pulling out the plug. You know, it's not real productive. You can't really take a bath because all the water just drains out. So that's why he really, you know, emphasizes trying to be as mindful as you can throughout the rest of your day. And I think having an anchor in the body is a really good way to do that. Body sensations are always there. There's always something you can feel in your body. And then it becomes a habit. It's like anything that you do regularly. It becomes more and more of a habit. You know, the other thing it can help with is, you know, a lot of us carry a lot of physical tension in our bodies, you know, from sitting in one posture a lot. We hold tension just for various reasons, you know. Anytime anything's stressful, we tend to tense our body up. And that's another thing this practice is very good at. Have more awareness, you start to notice that. You start to notice these areas where you're holding tension. And you can consciously let go of them. Maybe it doesn't totally go away, but you can consciously let go of them. And the more you practice that, just kind of turning your tension there often can cause them to just kind of dissolve. So that's another big benefit of that. And we can live a more easeful life if we have less tension in our body. So. Okay, so here's another practice that was talked about in the Satipatthana Sutta. I'm just going to, you know, kind of give you an overview of these practices, and it may be something you want to pursue or maybe not. You know, you don't have to pursue every practice that the Buddha mentioned, but I just kind of want you to have an overview of these different practices about the body that you could possibly do, and one of them you might find appealing. So the next one was mindfulness of the physical characteristics of your body. So really what you're doing is contemplating the body through its anatomical parts. You know, what constitutes the body? And this is how the Buddha described it in this teaching. Again, monks, one reviews the same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, enclosed by skin, as full of many kind and full of many kinds of impurity. In the body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, spleen, lungs, bowels, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, tears, snot, and urine. Not always the most fun things to contemplate, but that was one of the practices that the Buddha recommended. And why would we want to undertake, you know, this sort of practice? Well, one time, a lot of times where we're taking it, we notice that the body's attractive and delightful from one perspective. You know, we're constantly bombarded by images and, you know, in the media and commercials of people with attractive, you know, bodies. And we can develop sort of an enchantment about that. You know, oh, I'd like to look like him, or I'd like to look like her, you know, that sort of thing. So one thing is seeing the body as its components You know, a lot of these are the less beautiful parts of the body, not the ones that they show on commercials. You know, you don't see bowels on commercials and things like that, or body fluids, that sort of thing. And so it can help us start to overcome some of this conditioning that we have around desire related to physical bodies, or wanting our body to look a certain way or be a certain way. Often the monks use this. You know, the monks were celibate, and so they would have, you know, sexual desire come up, and they would actually use this. This was actually an antidote that the Buddha gave them. When sexual desire would arise, they would do that. They would contemplate the non-beautiful parts of the body, and it can actually be pretty effective practice. You know, it shifts everything, turns things around a little bit. But the other thing, you can kind of start to see the impersonal nature of the body. You know, we think of ourselves as this solid thing, but yet, if you really break it down, we're really all these different components. We have all these different components. You know, for example, you might see a commercial, a hair commercial, like a shampoo commercial, and they show this person with beautiful hair, and all the lighting is just perfect, and it shines and glistens, and they comb it, and it just comes cascading down their back or something like that. But then you see hair in your drain, it's not so attractive, right? Or you see a hair in your food, it's really unattractive. But it's still the same thing, it's hair, either way. But a lot of it is our perception. And so what this practice does is help us to develop a different perception of some of these things. You know, it can help us overcome, pride. You know, pride, maybe some of us are proud of our body. Maybe we have lust, it can help us work with that. Or maybe disparagement, we don't like our body. And we're attached to it. So this can kind of help break that. It's like going down to a lower level and helping us break some of that conceptual issues that we have with our body or with other people's bodies. It can also give us greater clarity about, you know, what a body actually is, what it's actually made of. Now there is one caution on this practice. You know, if we go into this with the wrong attitude and we start really contemplating the unpleasant, unbeautiful aspects of the body, it can lead to disgust and aversion. So you want to be a little careful with this practice. This isn't a practice you don't want to jump into and do hours a day. So you know, use a little caution. You know, if you're starting to feel a lot of aversion towards yourself or others, then you might want to switch gears and do a different practice. You know, even a loving kindness practice could be a nice balance to that. So just be a little bit aware of that. Joseph Goldstein told a story about a Cambodian monk named Maha Gosananda that came to teach the 3-month retreat they have at Insight Meditation Society, which is in Massachusetts. And he was doing a meditation on food, eating meditation. He was doing guided meditation with these students, and these people had been in a 3-month retreat, so they were pretty deep into the retreat. And so we had them, you know, pick up the food, put it in their mouth, and visualize, you know, what the food looked like in their mouth, visualize what happened to the food as it went down their esophagus, you know, as it got to their stomach and was broken down and went through their intestines and then was excreted. He had them actually, you know, do a visualization of this practice to look at food in a different light. And a lot of the questions came up, and they were asking him, why do you have so much aversion to food? They were asking this monk that. And it wasn't that he had aversion, it was that's how they reacted to noticing what food really is like throughout the whole process. And so I thought that was a very interesting way that they reacted to this particular practice. So you know, you always want to have some balance there with this type of contemplation. You know, you can contemplate the non-beautiful qualities of the body, but you can also, you know, contemplate how amazing the body really is. The fact that all these processes are going on at the same time, you know, that we can talk and breathe and our heart beats and that sort of thing, or the skills that we can develop, that our body can do and develop. So that can sometimes provide a balance, you know, if you're struggling with this practice a little bit. But what it can lead to is that there's really nothing to hold on to that's me or mine. You know, am I this part of my body? You know, am I my blood, or am I my spleen, for example? And start looking, it can start shifting. It's one of the things that can start shifting your perspective a little bit and start giving you a little bit different perspective on your body. Questions on that practice? So actually, let me give you a little more detail about how you'd actually go about doing it. You can have a list like this one. And you could actually go through your body. At first, you might have to have it, you know, in front of you. And you just contemplate a different part of your body, say like your head hair, for example. And you just visualize that. Or if you can feel it, some parts of your body you can feel. You can just feel that and visualize it. And then you just go through your whole body this way. You know, like your spleen, you probably can't feel. Most people can't. But you could actually, you know, if you had an anatomy book, you could easily look in there and see, you know, where's the spleen located. So when you got to that part, you could kind of visualize where the spleen is. So you kind of go through your body and you visualize all the different parts that compose your body. And so, you know, you could do that for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or you could spend, you know, a whole hour on it if you wanted to. I've actually been on a retreat where a teacher guided us through this type of practice. And it was interesting. It did really give you a kind of a different perspective on the sense of self. Okay, we got a few more minutes. I want to introduce one more practice. There's another one, and it's kind of similar, is that, but instead of breaking your body up into its components, you broke it up into the four elements. And back in the time of the Buddha, they thought that there were four qualities that all matter had. There was the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air or wind element, were the different elements or different components that made up matter. You know, they didn't have quite the same understanding that we do today. But a lot of them hold, and they can really be applied to a lot of these sensations that come up during meditation. And here's what the Buddha had to say about this practice. Again, monks, one reviews the same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of elements thus. In this body, there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So the earth element basically is solidity, the qualities of stiffness, hardness, or softness. You know, our bones would be a good example of the earth element, you know, solid, unmoving for the most part. Or when we're walking, you know, that feeling of solidity that we feel on the ground, that would be the earth element. The water element is cohesion and fluidity. You know, the flexibility in our muscles and things like that, the fluidity that we have, or of course saliva would be, or body fluids would also be examples of the water element. You know, you can feel the saliva inside your mouth, for example. And then the fire element is temperature, and that would be heat or cold would be the fire element. And also lightness of the body. If you feel sort of a lightness, you know, like say you lift your foot off the ground, that would be an example of the fire element as well. Well, and then the air, sometimes called it's a wind element, is movement or change. So like if you were feeling your abdomen during breath meditation, you feel that expansion and that contraction, or in your lungs, you feel the expansion or contraction, that would be the air element or the wind element. So you can actually contemplate this while you're meditating, while you're coming across sensations. You can kind of just notice, you know, what particular element that is. You know, say you're doing walking meditation. You know, as you lift your foot off the ground, that lightness would be the fire element. When you're moving your foot forward, and starting to put it down on the ground, this movement and the pressure is the air element. You know, that's the change or movement component. But when we place the foot on the ground and start to put weight on it, then we start feeling the hardness or softness of the ground, and that would be the earth element. And then the overall movement, if we're kind of just feeling our whole body walking, we feel kind of that flow or that fluidity, then that would be that big example of the water element. So that can be an interesting practice too if you're drawn to it. And again, it helps us kind of break things down into the lower level as opposed to this one big concept of the body. We start to realize that our body's made up of these sensations from these different kind of elements. It's a different way of categorizing the sensations that we feel as we go through there. You know, let's try one more exercise. Let's close our eyes for a second, and let's just feel our right leg, just the entire leg. See what you feel there. You know, do you feel sensations in your whole leg or just in parts of your leg? Is there space there between the sensations? Do the sensations totally follow the outline of your leg, or are they just kind of a subset of what we think of as our leg? Do you feel sensations in all parts of your leg? Okay, now you can open your eyes. Was there a sensation that you could call your one sensation that you call leg? Yeah, it's kind of a series of sensations, right? Mm-hmm. But when we think about our leg, we kind of think of it as a solid entity. Mm-hmm. But when you examine it, you start to feel that it's a little different than that. You know, I think this corresponds to modern physics, because when they examine things, they realize that it's mostly space, mostly empty space. You know, there's atoms and things like that, but between all the electrons and within the atom, it's mostly empty space.
Mm-hmm. I like to think, sometimes when I'm meditating and focusing on the body, that it is energy, because it's atoms and moving parts. Like, what it comes down to it is just, like you said, the electrons moving within an atom.
Right.
And all the atoms together, it's like kind of interesting. Like, yeah. Nothing is really solid in that sense.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And that can kind of help us break that attachment to things or self or things like that. It's noticing that it really is process, it's flow, flux. You know, when we start to see the body as parts, you know, through the practice of looking at the different parts, or as an interplay of these elements, then we start to break down that sense of I am a little bit. Not quite as solid. And again, you know, the more often you do that, the elements is a good practice you could do just walking around while you're mindful of your body. Just kind of notice the different elements that you feel. So yeah, these body practices can be very powerful. I think they're really at the very core of what the Buddha taught. Well, there's one final practice that he mentioned in this sutta, and that was contemplating the decay of a corpse. And he actually, you know, in India at that time, a lot of people didn't get buried, especially poor people. They put them out on charnel grounds, and they just let the elements and the wild animals and insects and worms and things just decompose their body. So the Buddha would actually have the monks go into these charnel grounds and meditate. Another thing was to overcome fear. They'd have them spend the night there, you know, and that's kind of a creepy place to be at night. And so he would have them focus on the decay of the body and see different corpses in different states of decay, you know, some that are totally skeletons, some that have just recently died and things like that. And then what he would have them do is actually visualize that the same thing is going to happen to their body as what happened to that. You know, we all know intellectually that our body's going to die at some point. Because there's no one that we know of that's lived forever, but this kind of brings you face to face with that, you know, and it can be a very powerful practice to do that, and you know, you don't actually have to go. You know, obviously, in this country, it'd be hard to go to a charnel ground and find that, but you can actually visualize. You could actually visualize a corpse. There's actually Buddhist internet sites that actually have pictures of corpses in different states of decay, and you can actually look that up if you want to do it that way as well. And and another thing that Joseph Goldstein recommended is that you could, like, you know, roadkill or dead animals, you could actually get out and examine them and see, yeah, they had a body, they were alive, now they're dead. And so that's a potential way you could do that. And and again, this practice is one you need to be a little bit careful with. You know, you probably want to start doing it in small doses. But that can give us, you know, contemplating the fact that we're going to die, can give us a bit of sense of urgency about what's really important to us in our life and, you know, our practice and things like that. Because I think that's one thing that we're kind of preparing ourselves for with the practice, is so we can be more present, you know, if our health starts to deteriorate, or, you know, when it comes time to die. So it's something sometimes we don't like to think about, but it can actually be beneficial to do that, kind of contemplate that. And also, this can help us let go of the attachment some to our body, knowing that it is impermanent. It's not going to be around forever. And so, yeah, but again, these are all practices. You could stick with the breath. If you just want to do the breath, that's great. But, you know, if any of these practices appeal to you, you know, you can give them a try, see if they work. The thing I do recommend, though, is trying to keep some body awareness throughout the day. if you can keep some attention in the body, that's definitely a recommended practice to try. So, any final questions or discussion? All right. Well, let's call it a night. Thanks for coming.
It's a very interesting topic. Thank you for teaching it to just two of us.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to.